I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're bringing you a special conversation with journalist Steve Waldman, whose new book, Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom, came out earlier this week. I first met Steve 20 years ago when he co-founded BeliefNet, a multi-faith spirituality website he went on to lead as CEO. Before that, Steve was a political journalist, working as a national correspondent for Newsweek and as the national editor for U.S. News and World Report. For the past few years, Steve has been researching and writing about the history of religious freedom in America, digging past the founding myths that we've often been told. What he's produced is a remarkable book that traces the evolution of religious liberty up to the debates of today. And he argues convincingly, I think, that our current political and religious climate risks undermining this fragile right. Before we share that interview, I want to say that we are still in shock over the sudden death of our friend Rachel Held Evans. I'm sure that we will spend time processing her life and work and the enormity of her loss at some point in the future on this podcast. But we're not in a place to do that right now. We grieve with those of you who love her and miss her. And now a conversation with Steve Waldman. I asked him to begin by tackling some of the misconceptions about the role religious liberty has played throughout the history of the United States.
For starters, it is completely misused all the time or used in very, very different ways. So as a starting matter, I thought it would be good for us to actually understand what it is and how it developed. It has so many misconceptions to it. Maybe the most basic one is that this was a country founded on concepts of religious liberty. It really wasn't. In fact, we haven't had robust religious liberty for most of our history. It's really been a 300-year process of developing a pretty robust model of religious liberty. I do think we do currently have such a thing, but it took a lot of blood and a lot of fighting and a lot of persecution and conflict for us to very slowly, piece by piece, build a form of religious freedom that I actually think is one of our greatest inventions, one of our, you know, something we can be proud of if we don't squander it. And you see that throughout American history, that a lot of times people say what they want religious freedom, but what they really want is their religion to have more freedom and flexibility, which of course is part of it. But if you only look at it that way and you don't look at it in terms of it being a concept that has to apply to everyone, then it's not really religious freedom.
Right. Religious liberty for me, but not for thee is a phrase we use a lot.
Exactly. Well, that phrase could basically describe the first 250 years of American history pretty much.
So giving us kind of a quick history lesson, what changed and when did things start to kind of broaden to recognize the pluralism in the country?
Well, as with a lot of things in American history, like with the rights of African Americans, it wasn't a single moment. It was kind of built brick by brick. So one major turning point, of course, was the Constitution. So the Constitution, in effect, the founding fathers were saying to the founding grandfathers that, you know, that approach you've been taking really didn't work so well. Because we had about, I don't know, 150 years of experiments with theocracies and different approaches where, you know, there was a particular religion that was the favored religion. So in New England, that was like the Congregational Church. And in the South, it tended to be the Anglican Church. It was kind of a European model. And it really didn't work very well. And so at the point of the American Revolution, 9 of the 13 colonies banned Jews and Catholics from holding office. So that gives you a little bit of a sense of, you know, that the colonial period was really just starting to wrap its hands around this. Now, the Constitution really did mark a big change, and it was notorious for being absent of having religious language in the preamble, and it had a ban on religious tests. So you couldn't say that only Protestants could hold office. And that's one we kind of think of as a no-brainer right now. But most of the states at that point had religious tests. So it was rather big deal that the Constitution said that as a nation, we couldn't. And then the First Amendment, of course, was the next big moment. Now, as it turns out, the First Amendment, it took a long time for the real meaning of the First Amendment to permeate. It happened gradually. These sort of state establishments broke down. I credit a lot of that actually with the sort of evangelical movement of the Second Great Awakening. But there were a lot of factors. It basically broke down. The next building block was the 14th Amendment, which was the, after the Civil War, saying that our civil rights should apply on the state and local level. Throughout this time, one of the key factors actually was immigration. We would have these waves of new people with new religions coming to our country. It usually caused a big backlash from the majority, but ultimately it worked itself out. And each time it happened, religious liberty was advanced. That happened with Catholics. One of the things I found, by the way, that was interesting in this is that you really can't understand the history of religious freedom in America without understanding the deep, long-lasting hatred of Catholics in America in the first, you know, for a good chunk of the country's history.
Definitely predated the actual country in terms of anti-Catholicism.
Yeah, in fact, you could say, to use that cliche of the tech world, that anti-Catholicism was a feature, not a bug, of the American experiments. Like, part of why they came, when you even think about the Puritans, when you say, what were they upset about? Why didn't they like the Church of England? Well, one of the things they were upset about is they thought the Church of England was too Catholic. And they came over here, and, you know, to some degree, the early immigrants were scared because they thought the Spaniards had a head start in populating the New World with Catholicism. So all the founding fathers were pretty anti-Catholic. It is kind of astonishing to read these quotes from these men who are so articulate in about the rights of man, just saying these incredibly bigoted things about Catholics.
Just sticking with that for a second, how much does that lead to, in turn, the creation of the idea among a lot of Protestants that America was their promised land? Specifically, not just for Christians, but for their kind of Christian.
Well, or that it was a Christian America, an idea of a Christian America from beginning. And it's what you realize when you read about the hostility with Catholics is there was this notion of it being a promised land, but it wasn't for Christians. It wasn't even really for Protestants. It was for a few sects within Protestantism. Hmm. That was the original, you know, the original promised land was for a certain type of Protestant. And that was true. There really, you know, there were people who came that thinking that the shining city on a hill was going to be this model for the rest of the world. And it was a certain form of Protestantism as practiced in New England that was supposed to be it. And, you know, gradually the sort of facts on the ground got in the way of that, where first it was with dissenting Protestant groups. Most of the early fights actually weren't with Catholics because there weren't enough of them. The first fights were with other Protestants. Maybe the most consequential thing was this massive wave of persecution that happened in Virginia in the 1760s and 1770s. About half of the Baptist preachers in Virginia were imprisoned in the years before the American Revolution, usually at the instigation of the Anglican Church. Now, it's amazing just because you don't think of it that way, right? The Anglican ministers were going around imprisoning Baptist ministers. But it's also really important because it all happened like literally in James Madison's backyard. This was the part of Virginia where he lived. So there's a direct line between that kind of persecution and internal Protestant fighting and Madison's views of religious freedom.
And what was the point of contention there between Anglicans and Baptists?
Well, it was this interesting mix of theology, culture, and political power. The theology is the Baptists believed in a personal relationship in God and a personal reading of the Bible that the Anglicans didn't believe in or didn't emphasize. Culturally, they tended to be less educated. and the worship style. It's somewhat like modern cultural differences between evangelicals or Pentecostals and, you know, Episcopalians now. And then there was a political element, which was that the Anglican Church was connected to the Church of England. So if you were a rebel, it tended to take you in the direction of being hostile to the Anglican Church. And then what it led to is that the Baptists developed a very different attitude about religious freedom. They really were the first ones to advocate for separation of church and state. That was really as much a Baptist idea as anything. And it was grounded in their own experiences of persecution and in a theology that said, we can develop our own relationship with God. We don't need church structures, and we don't need the government's help. We don't want the government's help. So it went beyond just saying, we don't want you to help the Episcopalians. They certainly didn't. And we don't want you to persecute us. We don't even want you to help us. We don't want that support. Government support's going to mess us all up.
I've, especially as a Baptist, always loved that about the history of Baptist, that they recognized very early on, and as you say, in part through their experience with persecution, not dissimilar, although it was even more dramatic and violent with the LDS Church, recognizing that separation of church and state was as much about protecting them from the influence of the state as it was from protecting the state from the influence of religion.
Yes, that's really true. And they thought it would, even well-intended help would corrupt. They really believed that. And Madison ultimately believed that too. They thought it would make church lazy and undisciplined and corrupt. And they had almost this sort of free market sensibility. You know, we should have to work for our followers. And if we're getting checks for minister salaries from the government, we're going to end up propping up bad ministers. They really talked very much in that, you know, a kind of market-oriented way about why this was bad for the health of a religion.
And we know, of course, or at least now this is my editorializing, that there are plenty of bad ministers who are propped up by checks from their own followers.
That's true. That's true. That's true. They were maybe a little overly romantic. And then just to continue with the building blocks, if you look at the 19th century, to grossly oversimplify it, there were a few massive conflicts. One was with Mormons, the rise of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Another was the ongoing battle with Catholics. And then the other two that I write about in the book are the spiritual treatment of slaves and Native Americans. Those were all massive consequential struggles in the course of the 19th century. And, you know, the attacks on Mormons in particular are just astonishing. I mean, I knew that they'd been persecuted, but I didn't until I got deep into the research really fully understand the depth of it. I mean, there was literally an order, an official order given by the governor of Missouri to exterminate the Mormon population in Missouri. And it led to one of the biggest religious massacres that we've had in the United States, the Hawns Mill Massacre, where a militia composed of civic leaders of the town went to this Mormon community and just mowed them down, just massacred the community. So the story of the Mormons and then the fights with the Catholics were really gruesome, but by the end of the century, forced America to expand its definition. Although the majority viewed both of those religions as repulsive and abnormal, and certainly not what the founding fathers had in mind when they imagined a Christian America. So they were real challenges to this idea of religious freedom. It was like, oh, so religious freedom can't just mean freedom for the types of Christianity that we like. It has to also apply to religious denominations or sects that we don't like. So that was really pressed upon them by the fight with the Catholics and Mormons.
And so what was kind of one of the arguments that turned the tide there towards expanding the understanding of religious freedom to include a group like Catholics?
Well, sadly, it wasn't really an argument that won. It was voting power. The one thing that the Mormons and the Catholics had that the slaves and Native Americans didn't have was a voting bloc. And in the case of Catholics, it was because of immigration. And at a certain point, you just started to have pockets, certain cities and states that just had a lot of Catholics, and they started to become a voting bloc. And you started to, you know, mayors become Catholic, and you had presidential elections start paying attention to that. With Mormons, it was a little more precise, which was the Mormons had not just populated Utah, they had populated four or five other states out west, Nevada and Arizona, Wyoming, Idaho. And it was around that time, sort of the last quarter of the 19th century, that the whole politics was sort of shifting west. And the Republican Party, which had been the lead persecutors of the Mormons, suddenly realized that, like, oh my God, there's like six Senate seats that could be turned on the basis of Mormon votes. And so they kind of made peace with the Mormons after really attacking them for several decades. They had one requirement, which was that Mormons had to give up polygamy. And ultimately, sort of a fascinating story, the church decided to do that. And once they did, they were let in. So I think that was really key to the both of those rising. Now, they were making arguments along the way. You know, they were making religious freedom arguments. So it wasn't entirely a raw power thing. One of the most fascinating parts of that was we tend to think in modern times when you talk about religion in the public schools, that this was something that was brought about by, you know, atheists or the ACLU. In fact, the Bible was taught in public schools from the beginning. What started to happen in the 1830s and throughout the 19th century was a fight between Protestants and Catholics over which translation of the Bible ought to be taught. So in other words, they both wanted the Bible taught in schools. They both thought that was a great idea. But the Protestants insisted on teaching the King James Bible, or what they would refer to as the Bible. And the Catholics said, that's ridiculous. That's the Protestant Bible. We should be allowed to teach the translations that Catholics are more comfortable with.
And in fact, that was the root of parochial schools.
Yes, right. So you ended up with the Protestants in a decision that, you know, was really quite consequential, basically said, we would rather have no Bible taught in the public schools than have the Catholic Bible taught, even alongside ours, because that gives it too much legitimacy. But for the most part, what happened simultaneous with that was that the, as you said, the Catholics then developed parochial schools where they could teach the Bible the way they wanted to teach it, or teach the religion the way they wanted to teach it.
And I have to note just one similarity with some arguments now is that we still have localities that have fights over whether, say, you know, a town council meeting should start with prayer. And we have seen places that end up saying, well, you know, if we need to allow people to offer prayers that are not just our Christian and still predominantly Protestant version, then we just won't have any prayer, because we certainly don't mean to be willing to listen to Buddhist prayers in Hawaii. I believe this is where one of the places it's come up.
Right. Right. Well, I think that's going to be the more diverse we get, that trade-off is going to come up over and over again of like, you have two choices. You can be secular or you can be pluralistically mm-hmm. religious. Like, those are your two choices. Over time, you're not going to be able to just be generic Christian as much. And, you know, some may choose the secular route.
So you've taken us up to the 20th century. And here, one of my favorite chapters is one that covers something that I think people feel like they know as a part of our history, which is the resurgence of the KKK, but they think of it in terms of race exclusively, and that was not the case
right
in the 1920s.
Right. The resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, the second Klan, as it's called, was more focused on hostility to Catholics. They certainly didn't like African Americans either, but the real thrust of it was hostility to Catholics. There was this, one of my favorite little documents of this research was a Ku Klux Klan songbook. They really liked to sing, and they had glee clubs around the country as like community building exercise. In this songbook, 9 of the 10 songs were anti-Catholic songs. And it was a big part of their message. They were very strong in the Midwest. It was not as big a deal in the South. It was like places like Indiana, Ohio, Washington State, Maine. And they got a fair amount of political power, and their number one argument was, we're the ones who are going to be able to defend you against Catholics. And it even got to the point where when someone was being sworn in as a Klan member, one of the things you had to pledge was being in favor of the separation of church and state and the public schools. It's like a very strange thing. And the reason for that was that at that point, they were equating separation of church and state with preventing Catholics from having any influence on the public school system. So they viewed them as connected. And then this all bled into the 1928 election, when Al Smith, the first Catholic nominee, ran. And it was kind of around the peak point of the Klan. And it was just absolutely brutal election in terms of anti-Catholic fever. Right. And a lot of the arguments or the messages that you would get from the Klan and their sympathizers in the 1920s were quite similar to what you would later see with John F. Kennedy in the 1960s. It was just, more prevalent and more acceptable and more common, and it gradually got a little less acceptable. But so, for instance, key thing was, you have loyalty to the Pope. You're not loyal to America. You have to follow a foreign law. And honestly, the rhetoric you hear is very shockingly similar to what you hear about against Muslims and Sharia. You're following a foreign despot. So that was part of it. There was a cultural thing, of course. It was connected to lower income, lower education immigrants. It was somewhat connected to prohibition. The Irish Catholic voters were pro-drinking, things like that. So it definitely didn't disappear. In fact, it wasn't until 1960 that either party dared to nominate a Catholic again. So it knocked Catholics back on their heels. It did give little glimpses of future Catholic political power. There's a lot of political scientists who have argued that the 1928 election was really when the New Deal realignment began, because urban immigrant voters started to switch towards the Democratic Party. So it had some impact there. The next moment where Catholics and others, and I think especially Jews, started to get more rights was World War II. And in a way, if I had to pick a single moment in American history where it really changed and really pivoted toward a more modern notion of religious liberty, it was World War II. That really changed everything. And it was really the combination of fighting fascism and communism and the need to articulate what was different about us and them. And, when you're fighting the Nazis, it's not enough to say we're Christian and the Germans aren't. That's not right. So the idea became first put forward by Roosevelt, but then also by Truman and Eisenhower, that what makes America distinct and what we're fighting for is not so much religion as it is religious freedom. It's this idea of religious freedom that applies broadly in the United States, that's one of our core values. And what came along with that was all sorts of efforts that seemed very quaint in hindsight, but were kind of revolutionary, for interfaith dialogues and operations between Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. There became this thing where trios of clergy people would go around to military bases or houses of worship, a rabbi, a minister, and a Jew. And I'm sure this is where the rabbi, minister, and a Jew joke comes from. Somewhere in World War II that the joke was born. I couldn't find, what bar in America it actually was born in. But it was because there were these masses of these trios. They called them tolerance trios. And they'd go out and they do these interfaith things. The rhetoric and the theology and the interfaith dialogues between the leaderships of the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, which had been fighting each other for hundreds of years, came together in a lot of ways. The national leadership became very conscious of it. 1948 was the first year that a rabbi gave an inaugural prayer. Harry Truman brought his rabbi from St. Louis. So it really changed quite a bit, and in particular, it was a big step forward for Catholics and Jews, because it was this trio, this triumvirate. It was also when you started to hear this phrase Judeo-Christian, which accompanied all three.
Yes. So I want to get back to that in just a sec, but also note that that kind of shift also needs to be understood within the context of the Cold War, because that is where you really start to get the rise of a sense of civil religion. And, you know, the famous quote from Eisenhower is that he wants Americans to be people of faith, and he doesn't particularly care what that faith is, although he did care that it was a more Christian, preferably Protestant flavor of faith. But that was the general idea. That's when we get Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance and Congress starting to pray, and I believe even more institutions closing for things like Christmas, which is a much more modern practice than the people who push the idea of a war on Christmas would have you believe. But let's go back to Jews for a second.
Yeah, the persecution and harassment of Jews, oddly enough, was milder than the persecution of Catholics for a lot of American history, for the simple reason that there were fewer of them. And American Protestants viewed Catholics as a major threat. When you read the anti-Catholic literature from the 19th century, there is this sense that there's this command headquarters in Rome, and they have these soldiers of Catholic priests and rank-and-file Catholics who are spreading out throughout America, infiltrating and following orders. Like, it was very, this sense that they were very directed. There was this thing, that hysterical thing during the Al Smith election in 1928, where someone had taken a photo of the Holland Tunnel, which had just been built in New York City. And it started in kind of, you know, viral misinformation, fake news of its era, said it was preparing to be a tunnel through which the Pope would come back and forth to America to rule the country.
That would be some trick.
Yes, it's quite a tunnel. So obviously, like, that's an extreme version, but it gives you a sense. Like, they really viewed Catholic as a kind of a wave that could overwhelm them. Jews, you had the same kind of anti-Semitic tropes that you had anywhere else, but they were small, and so they were not, you know, they were not viewed as the immediate threat for most of American history. Now, that started to change in the beginning of the 20th century, when you had the big wave of Jewish immigration. And that's why, you know, the peak year of anti-Semitism in America was not the 1830s, it was the 1930s or 1940s, right? Because it was there was more of a sense of Jews as players in society that could undermine the American culture.
And whenever there's been an economic cataclysm anywhere in world history, Jews have been the scapegoats.
Right. And the smallness of their numbers hasn't stopped them from being blamed for very big things.
Right. So one of the ways of describing the motivation for evangelicals changing what had been a distance from certainly political life in the U.S. for decades is the 1960s. And there are a lot of factors we can talk about with the 1960s, including a lot of dramatic cultural shifts that seemed threatening. But the Supreme Court and a couple of key decisions there are often pointed to. I've done this myself in my kind of brief histories of trying to explain this. To what extent was that actually important in bringing about a real change in the nation's conception of religious liberty, and in terms of how it was received among particularly some more conservative religious communities?
Well, there were two things that the Supreme Court did in the 60s that really affected the discussion about religious liberty. And one of them's gotten a lot of attention, the other not as much. The one that's gotten a lot of attention is the idea of, quote, kicking God out of the public schools or the public sphere. So they were the prayer and school decisions and related decisions. It sort of started to codify separation of church and state in a way that pulled religious language, religious teaching out of public domains, and more importantly, said when it is there, it can't be favoring one religion over another. It did actually leave a fair amount of religion in the public square, but it, on different terms. It said you can have general religion, what we sometimes call public religion or civic religion, that's sort of non-denominational, but you can no longer have the power of the state. And by state, that can mean the federal government or the city council or the school board or, you know, down to the local level. You can't favor one religion or another in your pronouncement. So that was a very big deal and did cut against the way a lot of things had been working for a long time. And conservative evangelicals or conservative religious folks of different religions were quite upset about it. They viewed it as squeezing religion out of public life. And you know, we're offended then as now, understandably, by people who say, well, you can still pray the way you want at your church. You know, they respond with like, that's not what living life according to your faith means. We want to be able to have faith permeate our lives and our systems. And of course, it was tied ultimately to all sorts of other social problems. There was a view that, you know, kicking God out of these institutions was what led to social collapse in other ways. Now, simultaneous to that, something else happened, which is that the court engaged in what you might call the accommodation revolution. Now, this is something that, you know, constitutional lawyers know, like, this is an obvious thing, but most Americans don't. And it connects very much to the battles that we have today. Before the 1960s, religious freedom meant an absence of persecution. Like, you can't tell me not to pray. You can't say I can't hold elective office because of my religion. You can't stop me from preaching on the street corner, things like that. It was like overt, hostile actions against your religion. Starting in the 60s, there started to be a different question asked. Well, what happens if a law accidentally or inadvertently infringes upon a religion? The big case was Sherbert versus Vanier, and it involved a Seventh-day Adventist who was fired because she wouldn't work on a Saturday. And she said, that's my Sabbath. And the state of South Carolina, you know, they said, we're not picking on Seventh-day Adventists. We're just saying you have to work on Saturdays. It's a law that applies to everyone. But the Supreme Court said, no, actually, in America, religious freedom has to be broader than that. The government actually has to bend over backwards to make it possible for you to live your life according to your beliefs and to make it so that laws can't harm religious people, even as a side effect. And that became a really important shift. That was really a revolutionary change that got built and built and built to the point that, and that directly connects to a lot of the debates we have now, like the reason why a Catholic hospital can say, we don't want to abide by the strictures of the Affordable Care Act. You know, they're not saying, oh, the Affordable Care Act has a passage in it that says Catholics are bad. It's just that the contraceptive provision infringed on their belief system. So a lot of the fights we have now, we are talked about with the same volume and passion as if we're still talking about hanging Quakers from trees or burning down convents, but they actually are gray area debates about what the right level of accommodation is. That doesn't make them unimportant, but it's a kind of a useful bit of perspective.
As is, I think this is right, the fact that certainly in the Seventh-day Adventist case and in some of the earlier, more blatant examples of religious persecution, you were talking about trying to carve out religious liberty for an individual where offering it would require a large entity, say, you know, a large employer or the state to bear the cost. And so many of the religious liberty issues that are debated these days are about the rights of the religious institution, although I suppose you could argue that it comes out through individuals, to make decisions based on their religious beliefs. And often in the case of, you know, a patient who comes to a hospital or a customer who is looking to be served at the cost of individuals, mm-hmm. kind of flipping it.
Well, it's we're in this realm where you can start to see the possibility where that religious freedom as a concept gets so muscle bound that it creates and is used in ways that are antithetical to democracy.
And where you have conflicting freedoms.
Yes.
Which is something, right. You know, I think we can say the court is struggling with right now.
Yeah. And it's part of why these cases are so inflammatory and never satisfy anyone is that these are not black and white cases the way the earlier ones were, at least in hindsight. I suppose they didn't view them as black and white back then. But we are in the realm of cases where there are different competing freedoms or different competing values that are both very important.
So that takes us up to at least the era that continues to define our religious political life, which began maybe broadly with the development of the religious right. And as you note, one of the maybe unexpected consequences of the religious right coming onto the scene is that it provided a way for Protestants and Catholics to work together to at least have common cause.
Yes, the anti-abortion movement brought them together. You had in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of evangelicals didn't want to get involved in abortion as an issue. They didn't think it was that important. And in fact, they thought of it as a Catholic issue. And they literally would say things like, I don't want to get involved in that Catholic issue. And over time, there were actually quite a number of Catholic leaders that were part of the religious right. We don't think of Phyllis Schlafly as a Catholic leader or Paul Weyrich or Richard Viguerie, but they were Catholic and they were important parts of the religious right. And gradually they made the case for why abortion should be part of the religious right's package of issues. Pat Buchanan was also important. He was working, another Catholic who was working at that point for Richard Nixon, and he made the political argument that this is a great wedge issue. This is the way we can peel away Catholic Democrats, is they care about abortion, and the Democrats are going to be the pro-abortion party. So it led to...
He was not wrong about that being an effective wedge issue.
Right, right. And the strategy really worked. And it had this weird side effect, though, of bringing Catholics and Protestants together around common enemies. So instead of their enemies being each other, their enemies became pro-choice people or secularism in general or communism was also part of it. And you had this final breaking down of the walls between Catholics and Protestants that happened in the 60s and 70s.
This is probably completely predictable, but my favorite part of the book is when you get to our part of history, which, again, it shapes where we are still today, but it's so interesting because the religious right goes almost in an instant from proclaiming itself the moral majority to also complaining that it is persecuted against. And we get a war on Christianity, which sometimes pops up as a war on Christmas. Most recently, after the deadly bombings in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday, a number of Republicans, including some in the White House, came out and declared that Democrats hate Christians because they referred to, I believe, Easter believers or Easter worshipers instead of using the word Christian, including Barack Obama in his statement about it. So this has been a very fruitful line of argument for some religious personages, particularly on the right. I would love in the time we have remaining for you to kind of walk us through that very recent history because it really does provide the context for where we are right now in this moment with a president who has identified that this is an extremely powerful and emotional tool.
Right, right. I think you hit it on the head, which is that he's not doing what George Bush did, which was to sort of have a spiritual connection or praise Christianity as a belief system or a source of comfort. He's identifying with them as victims and saying, you are persecuted. I'm going to be the one that restores you to your rightful place and stop you from being persecuted. So he amps up all of these cases of ostensible, you know, examples of persecution, which very often really are not examples of persecution.
Exactly. But it's a very effective, if extremely blunt, tool. Because yes. If you buy that appeal, then you have to forgive everything about him that doesn't otherwise match with what you say you've been looking for in a leader, because he's going to protect you.
Yeah, so it's not. It's sometimes in the press, it's cast as a pact with the devil around abortion and the Supreme Court, that evangelicals are supporting him because of abortion. But it's, as you're saying, it's broader than that. It's the sense that he's defending Christianity. And he has said things like in the course of the campaign, he says other religions are banding together and they're using their power. And here, if you look at this country, it's got to be 70%, 75% people, maybe even more. Somehow we have to unify. We have to band together. Our country has to do that around Christianity. We're going to bring Christianity back because it's a good thing. It's a good thing. They treated you like it was a bad thing, but it's a great thing, Christianity. So he's like totally, you know, amping up this sense of persecution and victimhood and casting himself as the great defender. And, you know, as we've talked about, and I know you've talked about on this podcast and in your own writings many times, like a lot of the examples of persecution really aren't examples of persecution or are massively exaggerated. I do want to talk about the little teeny, teeny grain of truth to them.
Yes, please.
But we should first recognize that it's, you know, is it two cups exaggeration, one cup malicious distortion, and a pinch of valid grievance? but there is some valid grievance there, which is that, you know, we do have the rise of secularism getting bigger and bigger in America, whether it's the rise of the nuns that you've talked about, or just a kind of more the militant atheists, or just secularism growing as a part of society. And, you know, Christians aren't wrong in thinking that at a certain point, religion can start to become disadvantaged and treated as a second class, getting second class status. I'll give you a personal example that shows just in a kind of funny way in Brooklyn. Like I live in Brooklyn, which is not exactly the center of evangelical thought, but it's quite diverse. And we were taking our son to visit the Montessori School's winter concert, and they were all adorable up there and dressed up in their little khakis and button-down white shirts, and they were singing American Pie by Don McLean. And, you know, they got to that lyric where they said, did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? Everybody tells you so. And I remember sitting there thinking, wait, there's something wrong with that. Everybody tells you so? That's not right.
That's not the lyric.
That's not the lyric. It's if the Bible tells you so. That's the lyric, right? So someone at this Montessori school thought that it would be offensive to use the word Bible in the Don McLean song. And they were very sensitive to, well, who is this going to, you know, is this going to offend people in the audience and stuff like that? And of course, what they didn't think is, well, taking it out could be offensive too to people who, you know, who read the Bible and who are believers. So that's like a little example of how we sometimes are very sensitive to the rights of religious minorities and secular people in a way where we're clueless to the sensitivities of believers. So there's a grain of legitimate concern on the part of modern Christians, which became a really serious thing for them after the Obergefell decision establishing the right to same-sex marriage. Because suddenly opposing same-sex marriage became just like, well, you were opposing a belief, to now you're opposing a constitutional right. And so Christians start to think, well, are you going to like start shutting down our colleges because we don't accept the idea of same-sex marriage? It was actually a legitimate question because, you know, the federal government did go after colleges that discriminated against interracial dating. So it's not a ridiculous leap to say someday maybe, you know, the government would deny benefits to universities that upheld the biblical teaching on same-sex marriage. So it became like a little bit of a more of a real thing. So that's my pitch for why the notions of Christian persecution are highly exaggerated, but not entirely fabricated. Like there's something there. The other thing that bothers me about it, of course, is that even though I say that there's something legitimate there, it so pales in comparison to the number one issue of religious freedom in the modern times, which is the persecution of American Muslims. It's like, it's just an order of magnitude difference, which of course is not the way most Christians would view it. If you look at like the hate crimes statistics, 1% of the hate crimes were against Protestants, 58% of them were against Jews, and 19% were against Muslims. It's not the only measure, but yeah, the idea that Christians are the most persecuted race is silly.
So I'm going to ask you perhaps unfair question, particularly with not a lot of time to wrap it up. But based on what you now know about the historical struggle to grapple with competing ideas of religious liberty, and as you say, often it gets worked out in political terms instead of arguments on the merits, where are we now? And if you had to kind of look forward, what are your thoughts in terms of how these could be resolved?
Yeah, I know I should have a good crisp answer to that, but I find it actually really hard.
It's a tough question.
Is a tough question because in some ways, you know, our religious freedom has never been more robust and strong, like in legal terms and constitutional terms. You know, certainly when you compare what happens here to what used to happen in America, we're way better off than we were. And we're really way better off than most countries in the world. I mean, on a just head-to-head comparison, Americans' model of religious freedom really is among the best in the world, if not the best. And so, and you even saw some of that strength, like in the attacks on Muslims, when you had other religious leaders come to their defense and people go to the airports to protest against the Muslim ban. And one of my favorite quotes was the head of the Anti-Defamation League, who responded to Trump's suggestion that he was going to create a registry of Muslims. And the head of the ADL said, if we create in this country a registry for Muslims, I will register as a Muslim. Because that is how seriously I take my Judaism, and that's how seriously I take religious freedom. That mm-hmm. is a good example of what has to happen. You have to have a sort of all for one, one for all attitude among different faiths, where they see their own freedom in the freedom of others. That has been intermittent in American history. We have more of it now than we ever have had before, but there's one gross exception to that right now, which is that evangelicals, who probably did more than any other group in American history to advance religious freedom, if you look at the first few hundred years, but I think they're on the wrong side now. And they're not looking at it from the point of view of understanding how these assaults on the rights of Muslims aren't just assaults on the rights of Muslims, they're assaults on the concept of religious freedom. And what scares me about this is it does seem like the consensus can unravel pretty quickly, like much more quickly than I would have thought. Like there was this poll that came out toward the end of the election in which only half of Republican voters were willing to say that Islam should be legal in America. Wow. Now that seems like that's a fairly fundamental collapse of the basic tenets of religious freedom, right? And that happened really fast.
And that's the power of the bully pulpit.
It really is, combined with the power of technology and this new media system. I mean, that's the other part of this that we haven't talked about, is that we've talked about, you know, the spread of extremism and things like that through social media. Well, the same thing is true with these elements that cut at the fundamentals of religious freedom. The social media system, Fox News, the president, these are all combining to potentially erode the foundations of religious freedom in a profound way. I think the single thing that could turn this around is if evangelicals reclaim their leadership position in tapping into their own forefathers, understanding that they were the ones who came up with the modern idea of religious freedom in America. They were the ones who really did more than anyone to make it a reality for the first 200 years. And they need to get back to defending that principle instead of doing what they're doing now, which is eroding it.
Oh, dear. Well, if we're going to put it on evangelical leaders to turn us around, I'm a little worried.
I guess the argument that I would make to sort of bring some comfort both to Christians that we're talking about and to the country as a whole will require a brief digression into something that James Madison said. Madison, he obviously was fine with the Bill of Rights, but he actually had a lot of skepticism that these what he called parchment barriers were going to do very much. What he thought the more important thing was what he called a multiplicity of sects, which he, in modern terms, he meant pluralism. He meant having lots of different religions all competing with each other. He said, that's what's going to give us religious freedom. And if you look at it that way, then the pluralism becomes the friend of the strength of religious freedom, not the threat. And we are at a period of peak pluralism as a result of immigration and other things. And I think that's great for religious freedom. That's actually part of why I think it has, you know, real staying power. And that this model that we've created, which I do argue in the book, really is one of America's greatest inventions, can remain so if we're attentive to how we got it so that we don't squander it.
That was journalist Steve Waldman, author of Sacred Liberty, America's Long, Bloody, and Ongoing Struggle for Religious Freedom. If you want to learn more about the topic, I encourage you to pick up a copy of the book, which is available as of this week. And that's all for this episode. Thanks so much for joining us. Impolite Company was produced this week by me, so please excuse any technical difficulties. And if you've enjoyed our conversation, please, pretty please, rate us on iTunes. It's the best way to let other people know about us. Until next time, have fun storming the castle, kids.